One of the nice things about doing a series of sermons on religion is that it's almost impossible to run out of material. There's always some new spin-off reported in the media to show how oddly we can behave when it comes to matters of faith. An Albuquerque man, for example, did not steal the rug from under the Pope's feet during last summer's great youth convocation in Denver, but he did buy it, 16 square yards of it. And now his advertising reads, for $3 per square inch, you too can have a piece of the carpet on which His Holiness walked. Free enterprise and religion, forever fascinating. Now, on the lighter side, two hard-headed male chauvinist board members in a very conservative church were upset to learn that the bishop had appointed a woman to be their minister. Nevertheless, according to a long-standing custom, they agreed to invite her to go fishing with them. By late afternoon, the fish were biting so well they were almost happy, until she said, gentlemen, I have to get back for an evening meeting. Well, then you'll just have to swim to shore. She could hardly believe her ears. But I can't swim. They were determined. Sorry, but we're not leaving with the fish biting like this. So she stood up, stepped over the side, and walked across the water to the shore. Whereupon one of them said to the other, I wish you'd look. They sent us a woman minister, and she can't even swim. I hadn't planned on this one, but that reminded me. I read a question. I mean, how many ultra-conservative Christians does it take to change a light bulb? Answer. Change? Okay. We talked last week about how wrong it is to make a division between religion and the rest of life. Being religious in heart and mind is an attitude that may or may not express itself in church membership. They are not the same. The religious instinct is one of awe and wonder at the mysteries of the natural world and at the tragedy and the glory of human life, so much so that one is drawn to seek some kind of relationship with the ultimate mystery, the author of all that is, the power or force we call God. And it's a simple fact that there are some church members who never miss a meeting, but who have none of those feelings at all. They may quilt, or drive the Sunday school bus, or lead the songs, or preach the sermons, and have no more of genuinely religious feelings than a post. It doesn't mean they are bad people. It only means they have confused organizational interests and loyalties with the great questions about the meaning and purpose of human life and how we are supposed to treat one another. If we are religious in that sense, we are religious all week. We're not one way on Sunday, and another way on Thursday evening at the Little League game. Real religion penetrates all of life, affecting our most intimate as well as our most public moments. But for thousands of people, religion is tenderly housed in a velvet-lined box to be taken out and rubbed reverently once a week, used in a crisis once in a while, but otherwise not a part of the work week, the vacation trip, school days, domestic life, all the stuff of ordinary life. We treat it, in other words, somewhat the way I treat my insurance policies. I keep them in a special box. I take them out at times to be sure I'm covered, and then I put them back until such time as I need reassurance again, or until my life is abruptly disrupted. Now, that analogy may be painful, because so many people really do look upon religion as a form of insurance. Openly, or in our secret hearts, we expect it to protect us from cancer and car wrecks, from the sudden and terrible tragedies of human life. Thousands, I think, go faithfully to church, not because they are keenly eager to go, or because they come away strengthened for that week's living, but because they have thought since childhood that this is how you pay your dues if you hope for a trouble-free life. Religion as a good luck charm. Popular television evangelists and successful mega churches use that appeal unashamedly. Let Jesus come into your heart, they say, and you'll get the promotion, the house of your dreams, the perfect kids, pray enough, read the Bible enough, and the storms will skip over your house and hit somewhere else. I tend to listen to this gospel for a few minutes if I stumble across it on a car radio, and I have heard Christ represented quite literally as an investment broker. Send $100 to this ministry today, and the Lord will bless you with $1,000. Cast your bread upon the waters, they promise, and it will return to you in magnified abundance. And they are speaking of material blessings. I should think that today's English version of that place in Ecclesiastes would be a favorite with them, because it says, in a very up-to-date translation, invest your money in foreign trade, and one of these days you will make a profit. It isn't always true, I can tell you from some personal experience. Now, that may have been good advice, that promise of material blessings for commitment to great spiritual ideas. That may have been good advice for the author's Jewish audience, and it may be good advice, sound economic advice for modern Christians, but it has absolutely nothing to do with religion. Religion is not a security system, either for finances or for protection of yourself and your loved ones from physical harm. We are not promised exemption from suffering and tragedy, and it is a caricature of the Christian religion to turn it into an insurance policy. Bad things happen to the best people in the world. including those of devout faith who never miss church, give generously of their time and money, and reach out in compassion to those who are in need. When the train goes off the bridge, goodness is not a guarantee of survival. I understand the natural tendency to say with relief, if you are a survivor, God just wasn't ready yet for me to die. But the God I worship does not get involved in games of selection on an Amtrak coach. To see a sign of divine favor in my escape from sudden danger, which destroys other lives, is an egotistical travesty of the faith that says, God spared not his own son, but freely gave him up for all of us. The book I read says we get no immunity from the common lot, no deliverance from disease and accident, no freedom from the hardships of human experience. What Jesus actually said was, if you want to follow me, leave self behind and take up your cross daily and come. Now, it's hard to imagine a more painful invitation. Leave self behind. I toyed with the idea of just stopping right now for 5 minutes of silence while you and I tried to figure out how that would apply to us. Leave self behind. What a simple, nice-sounding, churchy thing to say, and what a gut-wrenching, life-changing, all but impossible thing it is to do. Self swells up like a huge tumor, so constantly a threat that Jesus says, get rid of it. And this stuff about taking up a cross and coming along without regard for our own safety, what insurance policy have you ever read with words like that in fine print? Self first. Safety first. That's our motto. And it may be a commendably honest confession of how we actually feel, but let's not confuse it with a religion of self-denial and cross-bearing. There are ways of believing in the providence of God that will square with the gospel, with the life of Jesus, with what he taught. But the idea that God intervenes for his favorites is an immoral idea, insulting to both us and God. And it's an idea always doomed to come to grief, because no one who lives a normal life escapes sickness and accident and tragedy. There is no insurance scheme by which, if you worship God faithfully, you will be exempt from cancer or heart disease. What Jesus promised was that discipleship might, in fact, mean persecution beyond what others face, but that our sense of his presence and of being a part of the kingdom of heaven would give us strength to manage. I hear people say, stunned by tragedy, what have I done to deserve this? The only answer, most of the time, is that it has happened simply because you belong to the human family in which we sometimes get better than we deserve, and we often get less. we all gained. For example, when one of us, Sir Alexander Fleming, discovered penicillin, but some of us, the most innocent, lost terribly through no fault of our own when another member of the medical fraternity recommended thalidomide. What I am about to say now may be wrong for you, and you have the same right to reject it as I have to say it, but I think religion has to have a good bit of stoicism in it. I don't mean indifference, which is what some people understand when they hear the word stoic. I mean acquiescence, acceptance, instead of a constant butting of the head against hard fact and reality. There is, after all, a certain inevitability in life. Some things are going to happen. Some birth deformities, awful as they are, some heartbreaking accidents to the best among us. That little boy in my block years ago who tumbled into a thorn bush during a happy childhood game and was blinded for the rest of his life. Real religion has no clause to cover such things, except to promise strength to endure and the chance to grow into such pity for other people that we bless their lives out of the sorrow that came into our own. I can hardly say these things without reminding you of the famous scripture in which Jesus says, "Not a sparrow falls, but God knows." But how easily we fail to notice something, that sparrows do not stop falling. They freeze on some bitterly cold nights. They get diseases, they starve, softly, silently, they fall. It is faith, not logic, that claims love is at the heart of the universe, and the very one who expressed that faith most strongly knew that it does not guarantee protection. In that absolutely horrifying death by crucifixion, he swung back and forth between faith and doubt as we do. One moment he cries out to know why God has forsaken him. And in another moment, at the last, the absent God returns and he says quietly, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." Which moment captured the truth? Both of them, I suppose. Exactly the way it happens with us. When one moment we believe and our hearts sing with the glory and beauty of life, and in the next we are struck blind by tragedy and wring our hands in a paroxysm of pain and grief and bewilderment. There is one book in the Bible which devotes 40 chapters of poetry to the very question we are thinking about this morning, whether religion is a relationship or a security system. At a time when everybody thought that it was supposed to be a security system, a man named Job stood up and rejected it. Orthodoxy said, God blesses good people with wealth, long life, and lots of children. But he invariably punishes bad people so that they get none of these things. Job says he has checked that theory out against the facts and that it simply does not work that way. Bad things happen to good people, he argues. And bad people are often luckier and healthier than the rest of us. So the theory of religion as a form of insurance has to be wrong. His Orthodox friends, horrified by his skepticism, react predictably. They say, "You are supposed to be a wise man, and yet you give us all this foolish talk? You are nothing but a windbag. Have you no fear of God, no reverence for him?" And then the crushing charge, the one that is forever made when you ask a question, when you express an honest doubt, they said to him, "You are crushing religion." If those friends of Job were here this morning, they would say the same thing to me. Because they had committed themselves to a religion that promised to take care of them. And they chose to go on believing it, no matter what the evidence said to the contrary. So if it doesn't shield you from pain and loss, what does faith do for you? What does it mean to believe in the providence of God? Well, no one gave a better answer, I think, than the wise theologian Paul Tillich, who said that, listen please, hard, who said that providence means that there is a creative and saving possibility implied in every situation, that ultimately there is love that sees us through and works with us to bring every possible good out of what is undeniably evil. Now that isn't the pap of contemporary comfort religion, but it makes strong people and it brings us out on the other side of our tragedies wiser and more loving than ever. To reach that understanding of the meaning of true religion may be what the Victorian wit Oscar Wilde had in mind when he said, "The greatest service that could be rendered the Christian people would be to convert them to Christianity."